From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to our top story, President Donald Trump's decision to pull out of next month's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While Trump made the decision to cancel the summit today, he also called the moment a tremendous setback and said he still hopes North Korea will take steps to end its nuclear program.
All of the Korean people, North and South, deserve to be able to live together in harmony, prosperity, and peace. That bright and beautiful future can only happen when the threat of nuclear weapons is removed.
Balbina Huang is visiting professor at Georgetown University and a former senior State Department advisor. She joins us from Washington. And Balbina, first of all, your reaction to this news?
Well, frankly, it's not that surprising, given that with North Koreans, these things always seem to happen. It's very frustrating, but very often these, as I said, it's always a possibility that at the very last minute, these meetings never seem to quite occur as one has planned.
Now, so when you say with North Koreans, it's always expected. Are you saying that the instability of this moment, the responsibility for that lies with North Korea or with the president and his advisors?
Oh, well, with President Trump, the unpredictability is actually quite predictable. That in itself is specifically a characteristic of President Trump, but it is also a characteristic in and of itself with North Korea. So in this case, we have the confluence of these two that have met together.
Okay. So let's take a step back here because, I mean, again, with the 2020 vision is always the hindsight 2020 vision is always something we need to be mindful of. But in the past couple of days, was this moment inevitable ever since National Security Advisor John Bolton and then Vice President Mike Pence started talking about, you know, the Libya example? Did that, you know, put North Korea once again on edge here?
Well, yes and no. I don't think that is exactly what set North Korea off. In fact, we have to remember that this was actually quite calculated on North Korea's part. Remember that what was quite stunning was actually the turnaround that North Korea set off. Remember that the rhetoric from North Korea was quite calculated. What we saw was that North Korea had, for 5 years since Kim Jong-un came into power in 2012, North Korea had for 6 years had set off in a process of negotiations through the six-party talks, had been engaged in a process of denuclearization. Then Kim Jong-un comes into power and essentially set on a course of a process of very concerted and aggressive nuclearization, where he said that he was going to deliberately and aggressively pursue nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And he stopped engaging with China and went off and pulled out of the NPT and, against the will of the international community, deliberately started to pursue nuclear weapons program and essentially went against all of the will of the international community.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Balbina, but we have about 30 seconds to go here. I'm curious if you think that as of today, is the situation on the Korean Peninsula more dangerous because, at least for the immediate future, the possibility of talks are off?
Well, no. I mean, we have to separate the rhetoric from actions. And the reality is that North Korea has stopped, essentially stopped provocations, has stopped its testing, and actually today, yesterday, has essentially blown up its nuclear testing facility. Mm-hmm. So we presume. And aside from the rhetoric, it has not actually tested any missiles and has stopped its nuclear testing.
Yeah.
And presumably, that's what it has declared that it is willing to do.
Balbina Huang is a visiting professor at Georgetown University and former senior State Department advisor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump is also making news today on a very different topic, the NFL. Trump is praising the league's new national anthem policy. It was approved by the owners yesterday and requires players to stand for the anthem. They can also stay in the locker room while it's playing. Teams will be fined if players disobey the policy. Here's the president on Fox News.
You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. And the NFL owners did the right thing if that's what they've done.
Here now, sports analyst Mike Pesca joins us now. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, first of all, if you don't stand proudly, you maybe shouldn't be in the country. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's un-American, point blank. I think compelling someone to stand. Okay, just based on law, of course, is a private business, and owners can attempt to compel their employees to do so. It's also collectively bargained, so it's unclear whether this will go through. But the question is the wisdom, the civic statement, and ultimately, and of course this is their biggest decision, the economic wisdom of such an action. I am not sure how it will play out, but a case can be made that on all three points the NFL has made a mistake.
Do you think that the NFL is doing this because of the pressure that the president put on them?
Indirectly. I think what happened is, or I know what happened is the NFL wasn't on their radar until President Trump jumped over it and made it a national issue and talked about firing players at a rally in Alabama and people cheered. At the same time, there was, I believe, not causal, but a correlative decline in ratings. In fact, I can prove that it wasn't causal because ratings have gone down for every television program, I think, except The Bachelorette last year. But that's literally true. Hundreds of primetime programs. So the NFL is facing headwinds. I could name four of them. One is cord cutting, people watching less network television. Two is concussions. I'm not exactly sure how that's affecting people's appetite for football, but it seems to be. Three is the glut of product, Thursday night games, Monday night games, Sunday night games, too much football. And four is players kneeling on the field, some players in some games, but not often, kneeling on the field before the anthem. Now, of those four things, there is really only one the owners can unilaterally strike out against. And so that's what they did, and it's players kneeling.
And we remember that the reason that started is because of Colin Kaepernick, who was protesting against the treatment of minorities by police. Now, if you look at the NFL overall, 70% of the players are black, 94% of the franchise owners are white. The players had no say in this decision, and they're not happy about it.
Yeah, and I don't know that the decision will stand because the NFL has a history of imposing fines or levying fines, and that is what the penalty will be, a fine for kneeling. And then they, in arbitration, get revoked. They sometimes, Roger Goodell, sometimes gets out over his skis, and the courts have to intervene. And now the 94%, I think it's actually more than that. There's only one minority owner, and it's the Pakistani-born Shahid Khan of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Right. And beyond just the ethnicity of the owners and the players, who are these owners? These owners are largely Republicans or people who donate to Republican causes. I believe the Texans, Cowboys, Jets, Patriots, and a couple other teams donated heavily to the Trump inauguration. The Browns and the Redskins donated hundreds of thousands of dollars. The other franchises I named donated $1 million to the Trump inauguration. And if you look at donations, Republican versus Democrats last cycle, NFL owners donated $8.5 million to Republicans and $500,000 to Democrats. So they are of a certain mindset. They see their economic interests as being aligned with stopping these protests. But it's also probably the case that they are not exactly in line with where their fans are. NFL fans are, by and large, actually more Democrat than Republican.
Well, we're talking here about the NFL. If you look at the NBA official rule book, they also say players, coaches, and trainers are to stand and line up in a dignified posture along the sidelines or on the foul line during the playing of the national anthem. And Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, just told an audience at the Sports Business Awards that whether it's issues of race and gender, health, mental wellness, or technology in the media, what we do in this room matters day in, day out, and I encourage all of you not to stick to sports. A very different tone from the NBA.
Yeah, so the NBA has that raw law, that rule on the books. So does the WNBA. But when WNBA players in a protest violated that, there was no punishment. In fact, the WNBA, which is the same league as the NBA, or they have shared offices at least, they supported the players. I would also make the point that NBA players, the NBA is 75% black, the NFL 70% black. It's not so different. In fact, ownership, Michael Jordan's the only black owner. So The difference is there is a way for NBA players to get their voices heard, to have a say. There are fewer of them. We get to see their faces. Whereas 90% of NFL players are essentially anonymous. They feel that their teams don't want them protesting. So maybe that's why they feel more compelled to make this sort of public statement, because they have no other outlets.
Well, and now we'll have to see what happens with the NBA, because there's this video of police tasering an NBA player, Milwaukee Bucks rookie Sterling Brown, when he was questioned over a parking violation. We'll see how that plays out. Mike Pesca, yes. Here Now sports analyst and editor of the new book, Upon Further Review. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The New York City Department of Homeless Services is planning to convert a hotel into a shelter for 154 homeless families in a small neighborhood in Queens known as Blissville. The shelter at the Fairfield Inn will be the third of its kind in the area, and some residents are not happy about that, including Maria Davis. She's vice president of the Blissville Civic Association, which opposes the plan. Maria, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
And I have to say, I lived in New York for years. I had never even heard of Blissville. Why don't you start by just describing your neighborhood for us?
Sure. So Blissville is a really tiny neighborhood. It's in Long Island City, Queens. It borders the Calvary Cemetery, the Long Island Expressway, and the Superfund site, Newtown Creek. It's just all warehouse. It's all desolate. And there's just a few homes squeezed in between all these warehouses and mechanic shops and things like that.
And how many people are living there?
Approximately 450, and 100 of those are children. There's no supermarkets, there are no laundromats, and there are no trains. The closest train is almost a mile away. Everything is almost a mile away.
So why did you move there?
Because it was the only house we could afford at the time. That's it. We wanted to be homeowners, and it was all we could afford. The house was a nice, decent house, and we purchased it. We had a family. We had a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old at the time, and I've been there 17 years.
And you like it now?
I love it now. I love my neighbors. Everyone pretty much knows each other. You know, I think it's a great place if you own a home. For the homeless people, the most vulnerable people, it's not a good place because there's nothing there for them. According to the Coalition of Homeless, for the homeless, a lot of people that go into homelessness, they experience domestic violence, they have mental illness, there's drug addiction, there's all these things. And for people that suffer like that, you can imagine their life. There might be depression there as well. And to come to Blissville in the middle of nowhere for them, to be warehoused in an environment of warehouses, it just makes it worse for them.
Well, so you're making the case for why they might not want to be there. Why do you not want them there?
First of all, we are only 450. And if it's fair share, according to the mayor, that every community should do their fair share in housing the people in their communities who are experiencing homelessness. So, for example, in District 26, which is where I live, we're already doing our fair share. We have two. So this is the third. And with the third all combined, that's over 500. You will double the population of Blissville.
But the mayor says that they're opening 90 homeless shelters in the city, that they want to spread this around and make sure that everybody is doing their fair share. You say that's not what's happening.
That's not what's happening in Blissville. The first homeless shelter was Home Suites. The second one is in City View. Okay. And then the third one is supposed to be opening Fairfield. Now, we just found out the other day, there's a fourth hotel that's being worked on, constructed, right next to Fairfield. Is that going to turn into a homeless shelter?
So what do you want the city to do with all of the homeless people? I mean, at this point, New York has the highest number of homeless people since it had during the Great Depression.
Right. And so I think that the mayor should stop spending millions and millions of tax dollars on hotels to shelter the most vulnerable people, you know, because it seems to be someone is profiting off of the homeless, and it's not right. And I think that he needs to use that money to do affordable housing, mixed housing, or low-income housing. You can put homeless people in a hotel. It's still a hotel. It's not a shelter. And they're living in very small quarters. By the way, in Fairfield, they live in 14 by 10, two people, no kitchen. It's a tiny space. The cameras, there's like 95 cameras and securities and all this. I mean, when you think about it and when you hear the description, you see it for yourself, because I've been in that hotel. It's like a prison for them.
Let me ask you this. You are in Blissville, which is in Queens. You're very close to a lot of gentrification that's going on as well. Do you see the issue of homeless people being moved in as a bigger threat to Blissville's security, or Blissville remaining the way that it has been, than all of the rich people who are moving in right next door as well?
Right. Well, let me just say that one thing this administration lacks is transparency. And so lack of transparency from the mayor and the DHS contributes to distrust and doubt. And then that raises many, many questions, and people form their own ideas. Are they putting homeless people here, people with mental illness? We've seen them aggressively panhandling, even threatening the bodega store owner. Are they trying to intimidate us into, like, moving out or something, or selling our houses, or lowering the property value, or something like that? I mean, these are just questions that we need to ask.
Because you think that they want to develop, they want to redevelop Blissville.
Wouldn't surprise me. 11101 is very hot right now. And if you go by Hunter's Point, they're building like crazy hotels and buildings and all that. I mean, listen, my husband comes from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Okay. He grew up there in the 70s and in the 80s. He goes back there now. It's nothing like that right now.
Right.
It's all gentrification. And, you know, Blissville, we won't be pushed out. We're not scared. You know, we're not scared. We grew up in the hood. We grew up in the projects. And so we see a lot of this going on. We see a lot of this going on. When I heard about the first homeless shelter, okay, fine, you know, because it's a family, their children and everything. Then the second one, okay, family, children, okay. Saw a little violence and stuff, domestic violence that poured out into the street. We saw that a couple of times. But then when the third shelter came in, and then we're going to be, for lack of a better word, outnumbered, then you have to start talking about what is going on. Then you have to look at Home Life Services, the one that's supposed to be providing the therapy and the security and the food. By the way, where are these people supposed to eat? Because the dining area only holds 30 people. We're talking about 313 people. We're talking about the most vulnerable people, according to DHS, elderly, aging parents with adult children with special needs. How are they supposed to get around when everything is over a mile away and Blissville has no amenities, nothing to offer them?
So do you think that you're going to win this fight?
We're tiny but mighty, and we're going to try really hard to win this fight.
That's Maria Davis, who is the vice president of the Blissville Civic Association, which opposes the plan to put another homeless shelter in Blissville, a neighborhood in Queens, New York. Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And leave us your thoughts on this at hereandnow.org. The U.S. Census has released its list of the fastest growing large cities in the U.S. 8 of the top 15 are in the South. For more, we're joined by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the census measured this in two ways, raw population numbers and rate of growth. And when you look at the ones at the top of the list for rate of growth, it's Frisco, Texas, New Braunfels, Texas, and Pflugerville, Texas, all about 8% growth, and all places that maybe our listeners have never heard of. What's going on?
Well, the first thing that's going on is a little bit of statistical trickery, and that is that when you're looking at rate of growth from a really low base, it's easy to grow really quickly. You know, if Hobsonville has 10 people and adds 10 people, it's growing by 100%.
Right.
If New York City adds 10 people, it's not even growing. That's the first thing that's going on. It's a little bit of statistics. The second thing is that this is a continuation of something we've seen ever since the Great Recession ended. People have just kept up with the early 2000s migration patterns of moving to the South, moving to the West, and moving to hot suburbs.
And in particular, moving to Texas. If you look at the top of the population growth list, it's San Antonio.
It is San Antonio. It is also, I think you have Dallas and Fort Worth are up there as well. I mean, there's not a lot of surprises to me at the top of the list, except for two things. You've got Seattle, which is by far the fastest growing dense urban area in the United States. And then second, Columbus, Ohio. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. A lot of people don't realize that Columbus, Ohio is secretly becoming the second Chicago of the Midwest. It has been growing really quickly for the last few years. And so those are really the two exceptions to this general rule of hot cities growing quickly. It's Seattle and it's Columbus.
Largest city in Ohio, by the way, Columbus, and also still one of the top finalists for the Amazon second headquarters. Mm-hmm. Do you think people are moving to these cities in the Sun Belt, in the South and the West? Because of cost of living, because of opportunity, because of the weather, or other factors?
I think you named two of the really important factors right there. I think that in general, all things equal, most people don't want to live in Maine. They want to live somewhere where it's reasonably sunny all year long and often relatively hot. And the second thing is that a lot of people don't want to live in a tiny little apartment like I do in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. They want to live in a place that has, you know, a yard and a garden and a big house where their kids and dogs can run around. And in order to do that, you have to move away from dense cities toward space. Where is their space? Well, look at the Sun Belt from South Carolina through Florida, on through Texas, and then up through Arizona and Nevada. That's where Americans are moving to right now.
One city that did not look so good in this list from the census is Chicago, where the population is actually falling. What's going on?
Well, first, I should say I love Chicago.
Right,
me too. I
went to
school at Northwestern. I love Chicago quite a lot. But look, it's at the center of two not-so-great trends. The first trend is the demographic trend that I've already explained. People are not moving to the Midwest or the Northeast. They're moving to the South and West. And then second, Chicago is now one of the crime capitals of the U.S. The murder rate there is rather high, and they have gang problems that the city's trying to deal with. And so you put these trends together, both the crime trend and the demographic trend, and you have Chicago falling behind places like Columbus, its neighbor, and also cities like Seattle that are competing for a lot of the same jobs.
It's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Fortunes of the legal cannabis industry in the U.S. have whiplashed in recent months. At the beginning of the year, the Justice Department announced a possible federal crackdown. Investors retreated. And then more recently, a possible political breakthrough that could legitimize the entire industry. From Colorado Public Radio, Ben Marcus has more.
Being in the marijuana industry means accepting a certain amount of risk and craziness. Tim Cullen runs a small chain of marijuana stores in the Denver area. He says he's tried to stay zen about it all.
Tell you, Ben, when I started this, my hair was brown, and now it's kind of speckled and gray. It has been quite a roller coaster.
Not like one of those old, slow roller coasters. More like one of those new, fast, scary ones. In January, Attorney General Jeff Sessions gave his prosecutors free rein to go after licensed marijuana businesses. No businesses were actually prosecuted, but millions of dollars in investment capital dried up. Then last month, a shocking turn of events. Colorado Senator Cory Gardner announced a groundbreaking deal. The Republican said President Donald Trump gave him a verbal pledge that the feds would leave Colorado's industry alone. Moreover, Gardner says Trump promised that he would support some kind of federal legalization for the more than two dozen states with medical or recreational cannabis. Marijuana business owner Cullen says the reaction from people wanting to invest in his business was swift.
In the last couple of weeks, since Cory Gardner came out, we have had more phone calls about investors than we've had in the last 6 months.
An unlikely hero for the marijuana industry. The conservative Gardner put a hold on Justice Department nominees until he forced Trump to give in on the cannabis issue. Now capital investments are coming back to life.
Almost everyone we talk to is what I call cannabis curious.
Brian Vicente is an attorney who runs law offices that cater to the industry in multiple states.
They're interested in investing in marijuana, but they don't know how, and they're risk averse. And I understand that. It is federally illegal. But when you have the chief executive saying, hey, I'm going to try to help change things so it's not federally illegal, a lot of people don't want to be left behind.
Vicente co-authored the 2012 legalization measure in Colorado. But he gives props to Gardner, whose deal with Trump, if it pans out, would be huge.
I would say one of the pivotal moments in marijuana legalization in our country.
Senator Gardner says his current position is consistent with his views on government and states' rights. The founding fathers, he says, would have approved of Colorado's willingness to experiment.
They wanted the states to be the laboratories of democracy, and Colorado is clearly deep in the heart of the laboratory.
Gardner is now co-authoring a bill with Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren that would make marijuana federally legal in the states that have approved it. He hopes that'll solve a host of problems, not just threats of prosecution, but also access to banking and tax deduction issues. Back in Colorado, Tim Cullen's cannabis business recently underwent a painful audit from the IRS. He says without access to legitimate business deductions, he pays an effective tax rate of more than 70%. He says that must be fixed.
Without that, it doesn't matter. Marijuana is not legal.
Cullen is still a bit skeptical if Trump will actually follow through on his promises.
I'd like to see the Cory Gardner Trump exchange in writing, but I am excited about it. It is a big deal.
But it isn't a done deal yet. There will be several proposals that deal with the marijuana industry making their way through Congress, but partly because he has the president's support, Senator Gardner likes his chances. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
AAA says a record number of Americans will travel this Memorial Day weekend, which is the unofficial start of the summer vacation season. And vacations have a long history in American life. Joining us now are Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
And Nathan, you make the point that first we have to differentiate between the concept of a vacation and the concept of tourism, which are two terms that we often use interchangeably.
Well, it's actually better illustrated by looking at the early republic, but it's absolutely the case that vacationing is one thing that was done that was about basically resting, and tourism was a much more arduous job in terms of traveling and learning and taking in new experiences.
So who were the earliest Americans to take a vacation? Where did they go?
Well, in a sense, vacation, the way that we're thinking about vacation, is more of a 19th century-ish phenomenon. I mean, in the earlier part of the early republic, I think vacation largely meant not working. And certainly tourism, the idea of being a tourist, which is like vacationing with an agenda, that also comes much later. I mean, for the most part, you could say that in the late 18th century, people, if they went on a quote-unquote vacation, it was tended to be elite folk, and maybe they went to a spa, you know, where they could take the waters, or maybe go on a grand tour of Europe.
Well, I remember hearing that Grover Cleveland used to holiday or summer in Cleveland Park in Washington, which is like not that far away from the White House. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, definitely close to home,
right?
For sure.
Well, I think it's safe to say that, you know, as Joanne had pointed out, it wasn't really in people's bundle of resources to simply take a vacation for the sake of taking a vacation and traveling, right, as such. And so if you think about the late 19th century and the expansion of movements like the Chautauqua Movement in upstate New York, which are organized by the Methodists, where you can go and hear lectures, you can basically take in the sublime rural surroundings of, you know, places like the Hudson Valley. That was considered to be, you know, by Teddy Roosevelt's account, the most American thing one could do, right, is to go travel and to learn at the same time. The national parks, again,
National Parks.
Yeah, it was an invitation, you know, by Roosevelt to take advantage of these sites of rest. But I think it's also safe to say that when you look at the way that Americans tend to use their travel, there's always an element of needing to experience something new or learning.
I'm glad you mentioned the national parks, because I will say one of my favorite vacations of all time was a trip to Zion National Park, which was just incredible. Well, one early form of tourism might seem a bit disturbing, Nathan. Certainly, to me, it did. Americans often used to visit working asylums.
Well, that's right. I mean, given the limitations of travel, most people tended to stay close to home. And in some cases, that indeed meant going to a nearby asylum or a prison. And in fact, some people would come from all over the world, international travelers, to see the Great American Asylum. I mean, it's pretty remarkable on one level. You think about the 1830s, 1840s. People in the United States are starting to institutionalize the idea that you can, in fact, heal people who have mental illnesses or at least provide some new modern version of the old style incarceration of the so-called insane or those who have mental illnesses that was done in Europe. And so these asylums and prisons offered a kind of educational and moral lesson about the effects of crime or quote-unquote bad breeding. They served as a great counterpoint to Europe in showing American resourcefulness. And there's a way in which there were opportunities presented even to patients who tried to connect with travelers who would go to these asylums and sometimes even hand them letters to get to family members on the outside. It's also obviously the case that many of the patients were likely feeling quite humiliated by being turned essentially into a spectacle for travel. But the use
a tourist of attraction.
Tourist attraction. No, that's right.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting chapter in American history between the 1830s and 1910s, at least, that many prisons and asylums also serve this dual purpose of attracting travelers.
We often think of some of the historic Civil War battle sites as places that draw tourists today. In fact, Joanne, that started happening even before the war was over.
Right. It happened earlier than one might think. You know, I mean, I think when I first was pondering this idea, I just assumed that, of course, it would have to be much later in the 19th century that people would actually want to visit a battlefield. But early in the war, people went, like in the Battle of Bull Run, they just went to see the battle. That didn't necessarily go really well. There's actually a congressman, I think, who got captured by the Confederates and held prisoner for a couple of months.
Wow.
But even Gettysburg, not that long after Gettysburg, particularly there were Northerners, because not a lot of the fighting was happening very far north. They wanted to see what a battlefield was like. They wanted to collect trinkets. They wanted to sort of witness some aspect of it for themselves, which, again, kind of like visiting asylums, sounds kind of morbid. But to some degree, people are trying to understand something on a broader level.
Nathan, in the 1930s, there was an interesting book that was published that was a book for African Americans to show them where they could go on vacation.
Right. So as the country modernizes and the uses of different forms of technology really are put at the service of people's desires to travel, the automobile becomes a really critical piece of the way Americans understand their freedom and their freedom to travel and to vacation. And so, you know, you think about the great national parks of the West or needing to travel from north to south, that seems like a relatively innocuous move. But for many African Americans, there were great hazards in trying to travel, especially traveling from northern cities back down into the South. And so what's called the Negro Motorist Green Book, or the Green Book for short, was published in 1936 by a black mail carrier named Victor Hugo Green. And eventually, with some help from corporate sponsorships of what was then called Standard Oil, they really begin to distribute what becomes a guidebook or a necessary guidebook for navigating the hazards of both expanded post-war prosperity once you get to the 1940s and Jim Crow segregation, right? And it's also surprising, I think, for some listeners to understand that the Jim Crow South was, in fact, a tourist destination for people, right? It was warm there. There were beaches there. And it was not uncommon for African Americans to travel back into Jim Crow in order to find ways of enjoying the warmer climes. But it did require, you know, navigating, for instance, what do you do when you have a flat tire? Do you have to necessarily sleep in your car? The tagline for the Green Book was vacation without humiliation. And especially for black physicians or black lawyers or people who had the means and disposable income to enjoy the travel season, it became extraordinarily important to try to find places where one could take one's family back into the South without suffering certain kinds of slights at points of commerce.
Joanne, everything comes back in full circle here in history. Now a lot of Americans are flocking to destinations connected to the founding of America.
Indeed. And that also, you know, is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, for a good amount of time in the 19th century, places like Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, or Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, were kept alive by private organizations, but were hardly destinations of any kind. So really, it's a sort of mid-ish 20th century phenomenon that people went to a founder's house, except with one notable exception. Mm-hmm. So some of the founders lived long enough that they were actually known to be founders. And so, for example, people tended to flock to Monticello while Jefferson was there. Mm. And so he actually fled his house and went to a different one of his homes to escape the tourists.
I remember in his home in Monticello, there's a clock that he designed. And there's a hole in the floor because I guess the weight has to go down further than the floor.
Indeed.
Well, as historians, I'll ask each of you, what's your recommendation for if somebody wants to have a history vacation this summer, where should they go, Nathan?
Well, I'm going to be very selfish here and actually say go to Miami, Florida, my old hometown. Miami's got a very rich history, a history, in fact, of tourism that runs from the railroad to the great history of aviation. Pan Am had its hub in Miami, and it's a place that you can absolutely take in all of the Americas in the way that many travelers have historically used Miami to travel, not just to the South, but also to the wider Caribbean. So Miami's a great place with great history.
Joanne?
I'm going to be also really stereotypical, mm-hmm. and I'm going to say maybe pay a visit to the new-ish Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, right. Because it's a museum that actually is trying to tell a broader story about the American Revolution, and I think it's done particularly well, so it won't be just an educational visit.
It's Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
A retired Navy SEAL will receive the Medal of Honor at the White House this afternoon. In March 2002, Britt Slabinski and his team were headed towards a snow-covered mountaintop in Afghanistan. They were hit by heavy fire from Al-Qaeda fighters, which knocked another SEAL from their helicopter. The pilot landed the chopper, and Slabinski led a 14-hour rescue mission to save that man, but was ultimately unsuccessful. Sean Naylor is a national security correspondent for Yahoo News. He's also author of Not a Good Day to Die, The Untold Story of Operation Anaconda. He's written a lengthy piece in Newsweek about this Medal of Honor story, and he joins us now. And Sean, Britt Slabinski is getting the nation's highest military honor, but there's some controversy about it, so tell us why.
It's controversial for two main reasons. The first is that seven special operators died in that battle on Takagar Mountain in Afghanistan, six of whom were from the Army and the Air Force. And some of their colleagues have long blamed those deaths on mistakes made by the SEALs in deciding to go to the top of the mountain in the first place. The second reason is that one of those deaths was Air Force Technical Sergeant John Chapman, and there's a significant amount of evidence that the SEALs left him behind, thinking he was dead, as they were driven off the mountain, when in fact he was still alive and fought on for an hour alone against overwhelming odds before sort of finally succumbing to many wounds.
Well, so let's talk about that for a little bit, because the Air Force claims that Sergeant Chapman, as you said, fought on for an hour badly wounded before Al-Qaeda militants killed him as he was providing cover for an approaching helicopter. And this is based on some footage that Newsweek has seen?
That's correct. There's Predator drone footage of that fight, along with some Air Force gunship footage that's been sort of combined with it. That's part of the evidence. It clearly shows somebody sort of fighting alone on the top of that mountain at a time when no Americans were supposed to be alive up there. In addition, there was a member of another reconnaissance team a couple of miles away who says he heard Chapman repeatedly calling out on the radio at a time when the SEAL said he was dead. And then there is the fact that he shot all of his ammunition. When his body was eventually recovered, he was found to have shot all of his ammunition, which is about 180 rounds, which is almost certainly more than he would have had the time to fire had he died when the SEAL said he did.
Now, we should note that it's possible that Sergeant Chapman will be also awarded the Medal of Honor later this year, posthumously, of course. But Sean, let me just ask you here, is there any doubt, though, that Britt Slabinski, the SEAL who's going to be awarded the Medal of Honor today, is there any doubt that he acted heroically or according to, you know, protocol and what duty would call for in that moment?
There's no doubt that when Britt Slabinski made the decision to take his team back up to the top of the mountain to search for Neil Roberts, that the SEAL who had fallen out of the helicopter, that was a heroic decision. They knew the sort of the reception that awaited them then. And in fact, Slabinski has said that he thought that was going to be the last act he ever took, in his life. He expected to die in the attempt. Mm. And he also has been recognized for leading the remnants of his team sort of to safety, essentially, off the top of the mountain with two badly wounded teammates. The issue is that Slabinski has already been awarded the Navy Cross, which is the Navy's second highest award for valor. The question that has been raised is whether it's appropriate to award the highest award for valor that the nation has to somebody who inadvertently left a teammate behind during the actions for which he's being recognized.
Hmm. I just want to ask one more thing about what happened in the heat of the moment during that battle here, because Slabinski believed that Sergeant Chapman was dead. What is protocol around a moment like that, leaving a fellow soldier behind whom you think is dead?
Well, certainly it's not ideal, but if Sergeant Chapman had actually been dead, nobody would be blaming Slabinski for the decision that he took. And really, nobody is blaming Slabinski mm-hmm. for taking the decisions he took. And he intended to try to get back up to the top of the mountain as soon as possible to retrieve Sergeant Chapman's body. But in fact, his team was sort of driven further down the mountain instead. The controversy, obviously, is over the fact that it appears that Sergeant Chapman wasn't dead.
Right. Well, Sean Naylor is a national security correspondent for Yahoo News and also author of Not a Good Day to Die, The Untold Story of Operation Anaconda. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.